Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
And now your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night, and it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron is an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director publisher. He's a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project is the just-released documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Also, be sure to visit him on his website. That's www.ronchepsik. I'll spell you his last name, C-H-E-P-E-S-I-U-K. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio of my co-host, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, which happens to be my hometown, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he is a contributing writer to several trade publications. Last year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. And this summer, he'll publish another book about the famous Ganelda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie.
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. You're getting better at the promo every week. Thank you very much. You know what? They're selling like hotcakes, so hopefully we'll be out for another printing. Now, this week's Crime Beat radio show features three strategic media book authors. The first to join us in just a couple of minutes are authors Mark Silverman. And I don't know if Scott Deitch is coming on, but we'll hopefully hear him on the broadcast a bit later. They'll discuss their book, Rogue Mobster, the inside story of the New England Mafia. In the second half of our broadcast, we bring you Pat O'Connor, who will talk about his book, including the explosive investigation of the death penalty. The name of his book is Scapegoat, The Chino Hills Murders and the Framing of Kenneth Cooper. It's going to be a great show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Well, Ronnie, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some mail we received, I'd like to thank our listeners out there from around the world, that's around the globe, for tuning into a Crime Beat. They're giving us thumbs up to the program, and we'd like to thank the over 130,000 listeners that tune in every week now. It's certainly something to cheer about. Also, I'd like to thank the people at Artist First World Radio Network, Corey, Scott, and Tony for making this show possible. Like I said many times, Ronnie, before Internet, radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we are right on track. Well, Ronnie, here is this week's mailbag. This one is from Ramon of Santa Fe, New Mexico. Ramon writes, "Your show with Linda Scarpa last week was quite poignant. Although she described her father, Greg Scarpa, as a cold-blooded killer, she did share her genuine emotions with your listeners. She didn't condone her infamous father's activities, but she never lost the daughter-father affection she still holds to this day. I'm looking forward to her autobiography when it comes out." Any comments to that, Ronnie?
Yes, I think the interview with Linda Scarpa was one of our most poignant interviews. You could feel the pain coming almost through the telephone wires, right?
It was
really affecting interview. You know, she loved her father, but she knew that he was the Grim Reaper, you know, one of the most cold-blooded killers in mob history. But she's willing to talk about it, which takes courage. And we're really looking forward to her autobiography when it comes out, and we'll get her back on the show to explore her story more in depth. Willie?
Well, if her eloquence was any sign of the story that she'll tell, that book is going to be dynamite. It's going to be just dynamite. Well, Ronnie, now you want to give our listeners out there in the wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show, please.
Yes, Willie. Next week we got a command performance by Robert Forshen, the New Jersey Weedman. He goes by N.J. Weedman. He's one of the leading and most highly visible marijuana legalization advocates who has been arrested several times. He's going to be talking about why marijuana should be legal and also about some of his own personal issues that he's had with law enforcement and the authorities over the years. So that should be a really great show. As far as what we're doing, we posted the Frank Matthews trailer again on World Star Hip Hop. Can you believe this, Willie? Mm-hmm. In 3 days, we got 3.4 million hits.
Holy smackers. Way to go. Way to go.
That's really
something.
Of course, it really boosted sales. It cost a pretty penny to put it up there. We were at the very top. But, I mean, this is one of the top 100 most visited websites in the world. So it gave us great visibility.
Right. Well, you gotta spend money to make money, and I think you guys have got a hit there on your hands.
I think we learned that in the old East End, right?
That's for sure. Well, I wish you all the success in the world, Ron. I'm sure it's going to be a great thing for you. Well, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Now, here is this week's rap sheet item. Dateline, May 15th, 2012. Washington, D.C. Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger gets a TSA pat-down. Hey, Ronnie, it seems no one is immune from the tender mercies of the TSA pat-down. First, we learned that Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, was subjected to hands search. Now, a big guy like Henry Kissinger, hey, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, this guy was just once an advisor to presidents. He helped negotiate the end of the Vietnam War. Oh, yeah, and by the way, he got a Nobel Peace Prize. And they actually patted this guy down. Nobody recognized him. But don't let this fool you, because this couple of days ago, a report came out which indicated that the TSA, that's the Transportation Security Administration, which oversees airport security, took action to fix only 42% of the security breaches at airports in the U.S., only 42%. So this is all for show. And I'll tell you how bad the TSA is. I was in Burbank, you know, for the Hollywood show. Remember that? And coming back. I was coming through the airport, and one of those guys that checks you in before you go through security wouldn't recognize my South Carolina driver's license. He said it wasn't a South Carolina's driver's license.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, and I said what? And he said, I said how do you? He says because I see a lot of them, and so here you are stuck at the airport, security line. And so what? But I'm always thinking, and I advise this for our listeners, bring your passport.
You must have had a hangover that day. You must have had a hangover. You looked a bit different.
you looked a little bit different, right? Carry your passport because you.
Yeah, that's right. That's always the golden rule when you're traveling anywhere. A passport is
whether you're domestic or international.
That's for sure. Anyway, now just before we get on with our first featured guest, Mr. Mark Silverman, author of Rogue Mobster, will take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Shepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have a question for our guest, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you and try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's first guest tonight, as we said, is Mark Silverman. Author of Rogue Mobster. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Mark Silverman.
It's good to be here.
Great. You know, we think of Boston, we think of New England, we think of Irishmen, but looking at your last name, a lot of readers or pick up your book will say Silverman.
Yeah.
You know, which is a Jewish, at least, you know, what I've seen, and I know people with Silverman, a Jewish-sounding name. So how does that, you know, jive with what the New England mob?
Well, I can tell you one thing. There's not a lot of notorious Jewish gangsters in the New England mob. And although I do carry the Jewish last name, I am not actually considered to be Jewish, but I'm proud nevertheless. So,
but, well, how did this book come about? I know Scott Dietz, your author's in Tampa. He's based in Tampa, and you're in Boston. How did the book come about?
Well, I just began to write my memoirs. It was more of something to take my mind away from problems on the street, and it was almost an escape. And as I got to writing my memoirs, Don, I just began to realize that, wow, I've lived quite a life, and maybe it was time to share my story with people that may be interested in hearing not your typical mob story, which mine certainly isn't.
Right. Well, you said you led quite a life. Give us some of the details on your early life leading up to your connection with the New England Mafia.
Well, I was living with a single mother, and there wasn't really a lot of male guidance in my life. So I got into some trouble, and I really didn't know where I was headed in life, but. Eventually, I wound up getting involved with some people that led me into the life, and those guys were from a notorious Irish organized crime neighborhood called Winter Hill, which is where I was actually living at the time. This is probably when I'm around 18, 19 years old. I'm at a very impressionable age, and I started getting noticed by some of the guys because I was living basically right in the epicenter of the Winter Hill Gang on Marshall Street.
Right.
And it started to grow. I was under the tutelage of a family of bosses that were bosses at that time when I was around. And,
The subtitle says New England Mafia. What do we mean by the New England Mafia? Because there's some Rhode Island characters, right, in this book. Raymond Petrarca, who's a godfather, from Providence, right?
Yeah. New England Mafia is, it's basically all over New England, but the two seats of power are, as you just mentioned, Rhode Island, Providence. Most predominantly is Federal Hill, which is in the Providence area. It's like mm-hmm. It's like the Little Italy of Providence. And it's part of the it's where the boss usually was stationed for many years. That's where they wielded a lot of the power, where a lot of the orders came from Rhode Island. And over the years, it flip flopped, where sometimes the boss would be from Boston and vice versa. But yeah, it's absolutely part of it.
Right. Well, what was the connection with the New England Mafia with the New York Mafia, who most people are familiar with, and the Philadelphia Mafia? Is there any connection with those two big groups of mafia?
Oh yeah. I'm not sure if a lot of people know this, but New York actually, in some ways, are the bosses of the New England Mafia in a way, because they need to sanction the bosses as they come into power. As one goes down and the next one comes up, it needs to be sanctioned from New York, and they need to have the majority of the families to sanction that boss. And, we've done a lot of business with New York, a lot of, and we've done some business with Philadelphia as well, because Philadelphia is very, very similar to New England in the fact that they also answer to New York.
Right.
And, it works all, and I mean, all of this mafia stuff, it all leads back to New York.
Right, right. They're the patriarchs, right, of the mob scene in the U.S.
Well, yeah, they're like the CEOs. I mean, that's right. that's where it happens.
That's a good way to describe it, right?
Right, right.
I mean, that's where the commission was That's where the commission was located, too, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and New England did have someone sitting on the commission,
right.
And that was a guy named Raymond Patriaca, who
right.
Is credited with establishing, not so much establishing it from the beginning, but taking it into a sizable entity, making it, putting it on the map. And a lot of his ties were to New York gangsters and New York families. And as I said, he held a seat on the commission, which
right.
That's a lot of power.
Right. Well, the Petrarca family had a relationship with you, right? Raymond Petrarca?
Yeah, I mean, that's the name of the New England family. Some people call it the New England Mafia. Some people call it the Patriarca family. But, yeah, that's who, that's the New England family.
Right. Well, and what role did Howie Winter play in your life? Who's a very interesting guy who's still living. I think he's about 83 years old now, right?
Yeah, yeah. Howie Winter is actually my father's brother-in-law.
Right.
My father and him married the married sisters, and they've both been married to them for quite a long time. So I guess you could say he's probably part of the extended family of the Silvermans.
Right.
But how? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, excuse me. Go ahead. Go ahead.
When I was coming up, though, Howie Winter was gone. He was in prison. He was gone from probably like 91 to maybe 01 or 02. So.
Right.
He really wasn't there, but he was always there. I mean, the guy's a legend. The guy took this Winter Hill gang, and he made it into a powerhouse. I mean, he had a lot of help, and but the guy was the guy's just a real gangster, a real
right, right. When you say gangster, he's really old school. I understand that he had an opportunity to snitch, right? That would have really cut his sentence down, but he refused, and I think he got another 10 years added to his sentence, right?
Well, he's had a lot of opportunities to snitch because he was, when he was the boss of the Winter Hill Gang, Whitey Bulger and Stevie Flemmy were soldiers of his.
Mm-hmm.
And because they had a relationship with the government where they were basically calling the government shots, they put a lot of pressure on Howie because they wanted to find out information on the corruption in the government and what Howie would know, because he's probably a guy, and I know he would never talk about it, he's not like that, but he's a guy that he probably knows secrets that not a lot of people know.
Right, but he's kept them under his close to his vest, right? Like old style mafia.
Absolutely. The guy you know, he can walk the walk, he can talk the talk. He's
right.
He's the real deal. I mean, he's
right.
He's a guy that a lot of us younger guys tried to emulate. You know, he's the guy that gave us credibility. He's the guy that he's been through so much in his life too, and he deserves everything that he's got. He's on the street. He's got a nice family. He's doing well, from what I understand.
Right. Well, you mentioned the most famous mobster from Boston, whether he's the most powerful, is Whitey Bulger. How does Whitey Bulger fit into your story?
Well, Whitey Bulger was, when Howie went to prison for the first time, I believe it was in 1979, the entire Winter Hill Gang, including Whitey Bulger, Stevie Flemmy, Johnny Matarano, Joe McDonald,
mm-hmm.
The who's who of the Irish mob got indicted on a race-fixing charges, where they were making upwards of $6 million by bribing jockeys. And in other words, they were making it so the long shots won and the favorites lost. And he played a big part in that. But as the opportunity presented itself when the indictment came down, for some strange reason, even though Whitey Bulger and Stevie Flemmy were named in that same indictment, along with Howie Winter and the hierarchy of the gang, for some reason they were dropped from the indictment, and nobody could really understand it. And that was the first time we heard the term unindicted co-conspirators, which
yeah.
boggles my mind. Either you're a co-conspirator and you should be
right.
indicted, or you're not.
Right.
You know, and that raised a lot of red flags, and I think that gave Whitey Bulger the opportunity by getting rid of the most powerful, in other words, by the government taking down the most powerful Winter Hill gang members, it gave Whitey Bulger the opportunity to take over and almost build his own Winter Hill gang, because he didn't have a lot of competition because he got rid of them.
Right, right. Yeah, with the help of the FBI, right, and John Connolly.
Sure, and I don't think it was just John Connolly. Right. I think it was a collaborative effort.
Right.
Yeah. And well, hey, Ronnie, I got a quick... Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah, sure, Mark, I've got a quick question. You know, in the 70s, 80s, you had great sport teams like the Boston Bruins, Celtics, the Red Sox. You talked briefly about horse racing and how it made money for the mob. Was there a book on illegal gambling on these sports teams like the Bruins, Celtics, or the Red Sox? Can you comment on that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. In the bookmaking business, you know, a lot of these local guys, we made a lot of money when the Red Sox and the Celtics weren't doing so well. But on the flip side, when they began winning championships, we started taking a beating. You know, we started laying that action off to New York. You guys take it, you know what I mean? Because, you know, we didn't want to get stuck having to pay that money. So, you know, we got rid of some of it. But, yeah, horse racing, too. We took horse racing bets. We took a little bit of everything, but... the race fixing indictment I was speaking of was at a racetrack called Suffolk Downs. And that place has always been known as being, a lot of bookies in New York wouldn't take that action because of, as I just stated, of all the crazy, you know, because of what was going on, because of the 1979 race fixing indictment.
Right.
So it got a really bad rap.
Right. We're talking with Mark Silverman, whose life story... Rogue Mobster, the Untold Story of Mark Silverman and the Inland Mafia, has just been published by Strategic Media Books, and you can go to strategicmediabooks.com, www.strategicmediabooks.com, to buy a copy of the book and to get further information. And if you do, mention Crime Beat, and we'll give you a $5 discount on the book. And, of course, it's also available at Amazon.com. and Barnes & Noble, and other outlets on that. Mark, the book deals a lot with this war that went that erupted after Whitey Bulger went on the lam, right?
I mean, it actually...
The streets of Boston became a war zone between the Mafia and the Renegades. Talk a little bit about that, and then what's your role in that confrontation?
Well, there was actually two wars that were combined into one, because the original war in the New England Mafia started when Bulger and those guys were on the street. Mm-hmm. But long story short, from 89 to 94, during the first wave of the war, the government swooped in and they took down the heavy hitters on both sides of the war. Mm-hmm. So as you just alluded to, Ron, by 1995, that's when the indictment had come down with some of those leaders. Some guys like Whitey Bulger, who was the leader of the Irish mob during that original war, and Frank Cadillac Salemi, who was the boss of the Cosa Nostra during that original war. And when that indictment came down, Whitey and Salemi, they both went on the lam. And it's kind of strange to me, and it's still kind of strange to me, that Frank Salemi, when he went on the lam, he only lasted 7 months.
Mm-hmm.
And he had experience, because he had been on the lam once before in the 70s. So, I mean, he was no stranger to it, but he lasted 7 months, and Whitey Bulger lasted, what, 16, 17 years?
16, right, right, 16 years.
I mean, that's a red flag right there.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So I'm sorry, go ahead, Ron.
I was going to say, what was your role in the war that erupted?
Well, originally I wasn't under the Whitey Bulger faction of the Winter Hill Gang. I was under the McDonald faction, a guy named Joe McDonald. They were based out of Somerville. The Whitey Bulger faction was based out of South Boston, so. From 89 to 95, I was strictly a Winter Hill gangster, But as I told you, when the indictments came down and there became openings in both positions as far as the leader of the Irish and the leader of the Italians, there became another fight for power. And the Winter Hill Gang had trained me, and they had they showed me the ropes, and they began introducing me to the warring factions of the Italians. Mm-hmm. The Italians, who basically that was the wars that the Patriarca family split into two, and the powerful renegade faction was trying to take down Cosa Nostra and the Winter Hill Gang. So I was kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. I didn't really know what to do, and I was young, and I really respected, and I looked at these guys from Winter Hill that I was under as, you know, whatever they said, I did, and I didn't question it. You don't question things in the mob. I don't have a right to question those guys. But right. They were introducing me to the Italians, and I couldn't understand why. I said, well, what, you guys don't want me anymore? I finally put it together that, you know, they were introducing me to the Italians because they want me to maybe find out some information for them to maybe get myself in the middle of things. Because if you're going to win a war, the best thing to do is to know what the other side is doing before they do it. Mm-hmm. And if you could get somebody inside both of the warring camps, which is where I wound up, I was doing business with renegade leaders and Cosa Nostra leaders. So I was kind of like the perfect guy. And the Jewish last name was absolutely beautiful because they're figuring, you know, this guy can't be a spy. He's got a Jewish last name.
Right.
You know, he's never going to, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like if they had taken a 100% full-blooded Sicilian, I mean, right. You know, antennas go up. You know, maybe this guy's trying to get inside because there was a lot of guys that were double-dipping. There was a lot of guys that were trying to play both sides. There was a lot of guys that were trying to imitate it. But a lot of them got caught, and it didn't work out well for them.
Yeah. You survived. You survived that war, and you managed to not get arrested, right? I mean, the FBI did talk to you.
Oh, I had my first encounter with the FBI in 1992. I was 22 years old, and that's not a normal occurrence. I mean, that was one of the first red lights that went on in my head, is that I'm just a kid, and I've attracted the FBI, and they knew who I was, that's for sure. And at that original meeting with the FBI, they didn't offer me a deal or anything. That didn't happen until a few years later, because as I told you, when you are one of the few people who can deal, or not so much deal, but have a face-to-face meeting with leaders of Winter Hill, Cosa Nostra, and the Renegades, you're a pretty important person, especially to the FBI.
Right.
Because, you know, those are the kind of guys that are important to them. That guys, in other words, they crave information, mm-hmm. and they're not going to get some two-bit punk that's going to be able to give them the information that satisfies their thirst.
Right.
They want to get it from somebody who's on the front line, someone who knows what's going on, someone that can help them dismantle the warring factions. And I'm sure there was other reasons too, but yeah, I've had deals offered to me more than once, Ron. Right. More than once.
Right. Well, we're talking with Mark Silverman, co-author of Rogue Mobsters. His life story talks about the New England Mafia. It's the untold story. And we just got into it, and we're going to have to leave. But I recommend the book. Go to strategicmediabooks.com to get a copy. It's a great read. And before we leave, any comments? We got about 30 seconds. Any comments on and Bolger's upcoming trial?
I think you're going to see a lot of new faces at that trial. I think there's going to be, I think it's going to be the trial of the century, too, as far as organized crime goes. And honestly, I think he's got something up his sleeve, but that's just my opinion.
Wow, that's interesting, something up his sleeve. We'll have to watch that. We're all excited. Maybe we'll get you back on to discuss the trial when it comes up.
Oh, yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, right.
That would be great, yeah.
But we're with Mark Silverman, the author, co-author of Rogue Mobster. Scott Deitch is the other author. And thank you so much for being on the show, Mark.
Thanks for having me. It was my pleasure.
Okay.
Yeah,
thanks,
Mark. Pleasure.
Okay, let's take a break. Corey?
Crime Beat executive producer Ron Chepsik is not only a co-host of the show, he's also a crime writer and a publisher of other talented writers as well. Go to the publisher's website at strategicmediabooks.com to check these popular books out. Ron's books include the award-winning Sergeant Smack, The Lives and Times of Ike Atkinson, Kingpin and His Band of Brothers, which has been optioned for a movie, Queenpins, the first book exclusively about women gangsters, The Traficantes, Godfathers from Tampa, Florida, The Mafia, The CIA, and The JFK Assassination. You can also buy books by such noted true crime authors such as Pat O'Connor, author of Scapegoat, Scott Deitch, author of Rogue Mobster, Scott Wilson, author of Straight from the Hood, and Seth Ferranti, author of Prison Stories. Keep up with the new books coming out by joining the company's hot new mailing list. To get on it, email strategicmediabooks@gmail.com. That's STRATEGIC, mediabooks@gmail.com. The books from Strategic Media Books are also available at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com and through your favorite bookstore. When you go to Strategic Media Books' website, mention that you caught the buzz from the Crime Beat Radio Show and you will get $3 off any purchase. Again, the website is StrategicMediaBooks.com, STRATEGIC, MediaBooks.com. Come on down and you won't be disappointed. And now back to Crime Beat on the Artist First Radio Network.
Well, thanks for that, Corey. Tonight we also bring you Patrick O'Connor, author of Scapegoat. He'll discuss California's fascinating Chino Hills murders and the framing of Kevin Cooper. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Pat O'Connor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, Ron.
Great to have you on. We look at the title, and there's three interesting words. I think it's a well-chosen title. Let me say it for myself. Chino Hills. First, where is Chino Hills?
Chino Hills is in San Bernardino County, which is 45 miles east of Los Angeles. It was cut out of the... it's the biggest county in the United States by far, in the entire United States, lower 48. It's bigger than nine states in the United States. It's a humongous county, but it's 45 miles from Los Angeles County.
Right. And Kenneth Cooper, briefly describe Kenneth Cooper and how he relates to Chino Hills, and then we'll go into the investigation that you made.
Well, Kevin Cooper was in a prison in the town 3 miles away from Chino Hills. Is a town called Chino, which houses a very large state penitentiary called the California Institute for Men. And anyone arrested in Southern California is sent there for designation kind of thing. And Cooper was sent there for... two robberies in Los Angeles, and they classified him for they made a big mistake when they arrested him. He had somebody else's ID on him, and they only checked that person's ID, and so they classified Cooper as a minimum security risk, and so he escaped from. The day after they did that security, put him in minimum security, that he escaped from Chino Prison and made his way to Chino Hills.
Right. And subsequently, a family was murdered, right?
Yeah, 2 days later, a family was brutally murdered in their... This is in Arabian... Chino Hills, at this point, only like 20,000 people there, and it was... A bunch of Arabian horse ranches, and this family lived atop this hilltop house, many acres and fields for raising Arabian horses. Very, very isolated, remote place. And Cooper, when he escaped, on a Friday. He walked 3 miles and ended up in this Arabian horse country. And he found a garage that was, he could see the door was slightly open, and he opened it up, and then there was nobody in there. And so he holed up in this house, this vacant house, for 2 days.
And he held up in that house, and then what happened?
Well, the house was 125 yards below the Ryan's house. But he couldn't even see the Ryan's house from there. This is a really steeply pitched hill. And he hid out there, and as I said, he escaped on a Friday. On Saturday morning, about 10 o'clock, a couple, who occasionally stayed there, like on weekends in this vacant house, she came in to fetch a sweater, and made Cooper very nervous. Here he was, you know, escaped convict in this house, and so he decided he would leave that night. And he headed out for, he walked out there before 9 o'clock that night and went down into the town of Chino Hills and began hitchhiking his way toward the United States border with Mexico at Tijuana. Around midnight that night, the family, the Ryan family, this is Doug and Peggy Ryan, they're 41-year-old chiropractors, and Peggy's this Arabian horse enthusiast. She trains these horses and shows them at these different competitions. And their daughter, Jessica, their son, Josh, and then they had a house guest that night named Christopher Hughes, 11-year-old kid. They are brutally attacked in the Ryan's master bedroom, and the parents are killed, and the little girl's killed, and the house guest is killed, and they think they've killed the little boy, Josh. And they slit his throat and stabbed him in the chest, hit him in the back of the head with an axe. They left him for dead, but he survived.
So he survived. And so how did Kenneth Cooper get implicated in this murder? Because the way you describe it, he was away from the scene.
Yeah, and the little boy, he was found, and this was a Saturday night at midnight, and he survived by pressing his fingers to his neck and then going into shock. And that the little boy who was killed, his father came over to look for him, because he was wondering why he hadn't come home to go to church on Sunday. And the father saw, he looked in the master bedroom and he saw this incredible scene, blood and dead people. But he could see that little Josh could move. So he called, everybody else is dead, but little Josh could move a little bit. And he goes in there and he asked Josh what happened. Josh couldn't speak, because his windpipe had been cut, and they get 911, and they get a Josh is air-vacked to a hospital like 15 miles away, and in the emergency room they stabilize. He's fairly stable despite all this trauma he's gone through. He can't talk, so they do this communication system with a little, like a little clipboard, and they put the letters of the alphabet on it, and numbers 1 through 9, and they ask him, they eventually get around to asking, he's answered every question correctly, like his age, his date of birth, all that stuff, his address, and then they ask him, who did this to you? And he eventually says, it points to 3 white men. So, and he tells us there's a room full of people in here, all these emergency room people, doctors, nurses, they all hear, they're all observing this. And then he tells it to a deputy. A deputy comes over and does the same kind of thing with a different communication system, but it eventually comes out as 3 white men. That night...
Of course, Kenneth Cooper is black.
And Kenneth Cooper's black. Right. And that very night, around midnight, Cooper's now in now on the border. He's hitchhiked all the way to Tijuana by now. That night, this is horse country, so there's a couple, like a 60-year-old couple, they're dropping off a trainer at a house on the only road that leads away from the Ryan's house. It's just one road in and out. And at the bottom of this hill, they're trying to pull out of the driveway to go home, and they have to stop because there's this car coming down the street very fast. And they hold up, and they look in the car, and they see three white guys driving what turns out to be the Ryan's station wagon. They'd stolen the family station wagon. So this couple calls in this is the biggest crime in the history of this county. It's equivalent to or more so than the Manson murders, the Tate-LaBianca murders.
Right, and of course it's shocking by how brutality.
Oh, the brutality of it. That's what I'm saying. It's worse than the brutality of the Tate-LaBianca murders. There's 144 wounds on these people. There's, three amputations. The little girl is just beat to death. Just all these injuries to her. The stab wounds and all this. Well, anyway, it's a gruesome, terrible scene. And the first reports, though, the little boy says it's three white people, and then this couple calls in and says it's three white guys. And they put out an APB for three white guys in the Ryan's station wagon. So they were on the right track there for a while. But like 2 days after these murders are discovered, they find out that in this vacant house, they see signs that somebody had stayed there, and they do the fingerprint checks, and they find out it's Kevin Cooper, this escaped convict, had been in this home. So instead of the three white guys now, they focus in on Cooper. And they just say he's obviously the one. He's an escaped convict. He killed these people to steal their car. Even though the people saw three white guys in the car, they're saying, oh, Cooper stole the car.
Yes, and then remember, this is like, the listeners should be aware, this is like 1983.
That's right. So,
right, and Kenneth Cooper has been on death row since 1985. And he's,
that's right.
40 years old. He spent about half his year in life. And so, you know, you have this murder in a long time ago. It's in California. I know you don't live in California. So how did you get involved with this? Why did you decide to get involved with this case?
Well, back in 2008, I'd written a book about Mumia Abu-Jamal, this famous journalist who was on death row for all these years for allegedly killing a Philadelphia police officer in 1981 or 82. Anyway, I was, when that book came out, I did a book tour of California and in the Bay Area, and when I was doing this tour, there was four or five people that were supporters of Kevin Cooper kept coming to my presentations and saying to me, at the end of them, they come up and say, you've got to do a book about Kevin Cooper. This is a case, it's a case as bad as Mumia's in many ways, and in other ways it's even worse because these guys planted evidence against him. And so I didn't really want to do it because I live in Naples, Florida, and California's a hell of a long way from there. But I eventually agreed to do it. I met Kevin. I went out and met Kevin on death row at San Quentin. The law firm that represents...
No saint, but he convinced you that he was innocent, right?
Well, not so much he did. I could see. I go back and I read all the documents. I go back and read the police reports. I read the trial transcripts. I read all the appeals. I see what the issues are, and I could see a lot of what, you know. I don't want to use a phrase that maybe confuses people, but there was a lot of on the side of the prosecution of hiding evidence that was favorable to Cooper, that if the jury had heard this evidence, he wouldn't even have been on trial. Right. They wouldn't have had the guts to put him on trial if they had not hidden information that would have excluded him.
Right.
So I could see this in the I could see this in the police reports. And it was just unlucky for Kevin. He had a terrible trial attorney. I mean, you know, terrible in the sense that he didn't pay attention to the things that he should have. There was the very day that that Kevin was named as the sole perpetrator of this crime, a woman called up the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Office and said, I've got my boyfriend, he left bloody coveralls in our walk-in closet. They're caked in blood, and they have Arabian horse hair adhered to the pant legs. And I believe they're associated with the Chino Hills murders. Now, this is 3 days after the murders are discovered. This woman calls in and says she thinks her boyfriend was involved, and she's got these bloody coveralls. Well, they don't. This is the very day they say Cooper was the lone assailant. So they sent a property clerk out to look at him, and he collects them. But that's the end of it. She said, I want to talk to a homicide detective. Would you please send a homicide detective out? Well, they never do. And she would have told them that her boyfriend was a convicted murderer. He'd only been out a year from another murder.
So your investigation really, and I've read the book, compellingly shows that there's a lot of doubt about his conviction. And we'll get back and talk about Kenneth Cooper's chances of getting off a death row and what further is being done about it. We're going to take a brief station break, Willie.
You bet. What a fascinating interview, a great book for all you crime aficionados out there. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Harib. Our guest is Patrick O'Connor, author of the turn-pager of a narrative titled Scapegoat, The Chino Hills Murders, and the Framing of Kevin Cooper. Now back to Ron and Pat O'Connor for the remainder of the program.
Right. We're back with Pat O'Connor, author of Scapegoat. You can go to Strategic Media Books to buy a copy. Mention Crime Beat, and you'll get $5 off the purchase price. Pat has an excellent website called Crime Magazine, www.crimemagazine.com, which you could also check out. And getting back to the interview, so here we are. We're almost, what, how many years? 17 years, 27 years later.
Yeah.
He's had stay after stay, right?
And he did, yeah.
Is he going to die?
I don't think so. He's not going to die as a result of execution.
You think he could survive still? Because I understood that this year, you know, he was going to go, and you know, he's going to face death.
Well, his closest, he would be dead by now, believe me, if it hadn't been for a federal judge in a United States federal court judge in San Jose. He took a case, there was a case filed about lethal injection, you know, what they call the three-drug cocktail, that it was a violation of the Eighth Amendment, the prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. This judge, because they botched so many of these lethal injection deals. They shoot the guy up, and it, you know, only part of it, that they're not trained, they're not medical personnel, these are guards doing this protocol. And they botch it, and the guy he doesn't get enough of the first dosage, which is like the anesthetic, but he gets plenty of the one that paralyzes him and stops him from breathing, and then he gets plenty of the one that stops his heart from beating, but he doesn't get enough of the anesthetic. So he's there for, you know, like 11 minutes of this incredible torture of a death where you can't breathe. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of ironic to me that the lawyer that represented this defendant, this guy, was Kenneth Starr, who prosecuted Bill Clinton back in the days for the, you know, the Monica Lewinsky affair. So anyway, he represents this guy, and they win. And the judge puts a moratorium on lethal injection until California can come up with a way that is not going to be, you know, cruel and unusual punishment. Well, they haven't been able to come up with that way.
Now, what about Governor Brown granting a pardon? Has he been approached about this? It's Jerry Brown.
I know. It was kind of funny. The other day, you know, like 3-4 weeks ago, Brown said, and this really floored me, he said, you know, this is the biggest death row in the world, not just in the Western Hemisphere, in the world. There's 714 people on death row in California. I mean, Texas might have 200, Georgia 112, something like that. I mean, this is humongous, this death row in California. Anyway, he says, one thing I can say is I don't think there's a single person innocent on death row in California. So he hasn't been really paying attention.
He sounds like some of the right, he's supposed to be a liberal, right? And he sounds like some of these right-wing governors from Texas.
Yeah, that was a shocker. Well, anyway, Kevin's attorney sent him my book, and plus a lot of other stuff, and God only hopes that he'll read it.
What does this tell you about the American justice system? It's obviously flawed because you hear case after case.
Yeah, it's broken
somebody
pretty.
Somebody almost dying.
On yeah. Control,
and they mean exonerated by DNA evidence or some diligent people that took up the cause, like you. What does it say about our justice system?
It says it's broken, and it's not just a question of, you know, like in the Kevin Cooper case, this is what killed me about this. It wasn't just like one or two bad apples. This whole system was corrupt. They had to have the crime lab, had to falsify stuff. The detectives all had to be a bunch of fabricators, and then they had to have to be complicit. The DA's office had to be so complicit in this frame-up that it was sickening. The whole group was bad. It wasn't just like, you know, you think, well, there's a rotten apple in every barrel. This whole barrel was rotten.
Well, you must have thoughts about reform. What can be done to reform this, as you describe, a rotten system?
Well, one thing, you know, we're moving in a glacial speed, but like Connecticut became, I think, the 15th or so state. Yeah, the 15th state to abolish the death penalty last month. We're moving away from the death penalty. I think Californians will vote in November. There's an initiative there to overthrow the death penalty. But I kind of go back to what Clarence Darrow said 100 years ago. There's no system of justice in this country. Unless you gave the defendant as much resources as you gave the state, you know, hired as many lawyers, hired as many investigators, there's no chance for justice to take place. It's a stacked deck.
Right, and there are very few rich people on death row, right?
There are no rich people on death row. You know, not one, and this is interesting to me. I mean, it just really proves the point. There's never been a rich person executed in the United States, and we have executed thousands and thousands, but not one rich person.
Yeah. Good point. It's like a fascinating point.
Legal war on the poor, right?
It's a war on the indigent. Just don't be indigent.
And we're going to have to stop there with this fascinating discussion with Pat O'Connor. And I suggest getting a copy of his book, Scapegoat, which is available from strategicmediabooks.com. Mention Crime Beat radio show and get $5 off the purchase. You can also go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets to get a copy of it. It's a great read, and it makes a compelling case about a miscarriage of justice in California. Pat, thank you for being on the show.
All right, Ron. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Right.
Yeah, thanks, Pat.
Good luck. Thank you.
Interview. All right.
Willie.
Well, thanks again, Willie. Yeah, terrific. That book, I'm going to get that book and read it for sure. It's just fascinating.
It's been incredible. You can't believe this happens in America.
Really? I mean, the horror that went on that day. We forgot to ask how Josh is doing today. He must be in his 30s.
I would suggest our readers get a copy of the book.
You bet. Absolutely. Yeah, you will find out there. Well, again, thanks to our guests, Mark Silverman and Patrick O'Connor. We're delighted to have them on our program. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about our show tonight?
Well, I learned that I have two or three great authors and two books. They're both great reads, and I recommend that our audience get a copy of those books, because they're well worth the money. How about you, Willie?
Yeah, that's for sure, Ron.
Well, I learned that the Boston mob rivaled the deadly Italian mafia in every way, man. And war resulted because of that. You know, sometimes very, very vicious. Also, I learned that Kevin Cooper is a poster boy for wrongfully accused individuals. Both very, very fascinating stories. One thing I know also for sure is that the books they wrote, you won't want to put them down, so go out there and buy them. Great reads, absolutely great reads. Now, Ronnie, we're going to give you our gangster nickname of the month segment. Hey, Ronnie, you remember this guy, Salvadori Sammy Meatballs Apparel?
Guy was a former household name. Household name.
Yeah. Well, you know, he was a former capo in the notorious Genovese crime family in the year 2000.
Capo, that doesn't mean anything sexual, does it?
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. But anyway, this guy, they tried to get rid of the union guys, and he got caught, and he was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison for racketeering. He got out 6 years ago, man. But I wonder what he's doing now. I wonder if he's eating a lot of spaghetti and meatballs.
Yeah, you can't believe these names, right? Imagine being stuck with
absolutely
a name like meatballs. I mean, you know, the mafia ran out of nicknames, right?
Now,
of course,
well,
sometimes it's better than being called Meathead, which I call you sometimes, right?
Well, yeah. Well, I won't tell our listeners what I call you now and again.
Right. We'll keep the show clean.
You bet. Now, just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for May the 24th. We'll have Robert Forshin in a command appearance. Robert Forshin will discuss his controversial quest for the legalization of marijuana. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss that one, that's for sure. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are, we would like to thank you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. And please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Chapsick and myself, we hope you tune in to Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Good night, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Stay tight, Willie.